1 Corinthians chapter 9 in the New Testament, verses 1 to 27. And let me start at the second part of verse 12, which I submit is the key sentence of all these 27 verses. Second part. But, writes Paul, and there's always something important coming whenever the great apostle says but, we did not use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. That single sentence tells us where Paul's epicenter was for the whole of his life. Nothing else mattered but the gospel, and nothing else does matter but the gospel. So we must ask ourselves the question, what occupies the center? There was a man of the 4th century AD called Eusebius Hieronymus Jerome, who became a fine scholar. When he was in his late 20s, he dreamt one night that he died and had gone to the gates of heaven. And the gatekeeper stopped him at the gates and said, "Who are you?" And Jerome replied, "Christianus sum." "I'm a Christian." "No," said the gatekeeper. "You're not a Christian, you're a Ciceronian, because your thoughts and studies when you were there on earth were most of all in your life directed to the works of Cicero and the classics, and you neglected the teachings of Jesus." "We judge people here," said the gatekeeper, "by what most takes up their thoughts, and you are judged not to be a Christian but a Ciceronian. Sorry." And Jerome awoke with a start and put aside the classics as his primary study and said, "I will be a Christian." You know what resulted? Jerome gave himself to producing a new translation of the Bible. He prayed and worked over the old ancient manuscripts, and the result was the Vulgate version of the Bible that served the church for centuries to come. What are we recognized for most? I suppose of ourselves it could be said, well, yes, perhaps they're somewhat Christian, but they are in fact most themselves when they're concentrating about engineering, politics, gardening, the family, sport, business, architecture, music. What are you most? This passage of 1 Corinthians 9 helps us with the centrality of the Christian gospel in all our priorities and privileges. Paul is a great model for us here. Other things were set aside for the sake of the gospel. Verse 12 again, second half, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. So three ideas come tumbling through this chapter, and they all have to do with the priority of the gospel for Paul over everything else. The gospel is the one thing that makes sense of life, reinstating us as forgiven people through Christ's death and resurrection, introducing us by a relationship of prayer to friendship with God, assuring a man or woman of a place in the church and of life that is forever. Nothing, says Paul, must hinder that. This priority of the gospel affects everything else in life. To begin with, it affects how we see our rights. Paul is really only here continuing his emphasis from the previous chapter 8, where he'd urged the giving up of certain rights by Christian people for the sake of those weaker believers, remember the last study? Those weaker believers who would be stumbled by the actions of those Christians exercising their freedom. As Paul puts it in chapter 8, verse 13, therefore if what I eat causes my brother to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again, so that I will not cause him to sin. Would it matter, a Christian eating meat that at a certain point had been sacrificially offered to idols? Not at all. Those idols had no animated existence. A Christian was free to eat such meat without being contaminated at all spiritually. Ah, but then if it was eaten in front of a new Christian who had only just come out of idolatry and still attributed some sort of identity to those idols, why then, said Paul, there would be a case for holding back on one's freedom, on one's rights, so as not to harm the sensitivities of that new, weaker Christian. So as we come now to chapter 9, it really is a natural follow-up, as Paul applies that argument first to himself as the model, and then really to all who are in the service of Christ. Are you in the service of Christ? Being given some form of leadership, service, work for him? I believe this passage applies to us. But here is Paul now applying the principle first to himself. Am I not free? Chapter 9, verse 1. He's saying, can't I pull rank? In fact, am I not an apostle? Yes, like the other apostles, he'd seen the Lord. He makes that point here. In fact, he'd had the advantage not only of seeing Jesus in his resurrected state, but also in his glorified state as ascended Son of Man. The Corinthians should have been the last people to believe the lies of the rival false apostles who were then around, who held that Paul was no real apostle at all. Because, we read in that same first verse, the Corinthian believers came into being as a church as a result of Paul's own ministry. Surely, he says in verse 2, have a look at the verse. I'm an apostle to you, he's saying. Why, you're the seal, you're the living proof of my apostleship. You're the proof. Oh, Paul's an apostle. And he could surely pull rank and claim all sorts of privileges as an apostle. Nobody would have quarreled. Living expenses, claim slips, food and drink, verse 4. And like Peter and other married apostles, the right, verse 5, if he had a wife, to have your wife being subsidized to come with you on speaking trips. Oh, he could do that. It's all listed out here. Paul makes the point, as firmly as he can, that the priority of the gospel in his life affects how he sees his rights, even as an apostle. His rights to material support as much as anything else. The word rights features a number of times in this chapter. Now have a look with me. Let's just do a little bit of Bible work. Verse 4, don't we have the right to food and drink? Verse 5, don't we have the right to take a believing wife along with us, as do the other apostles? Or is it only I and Barnabas who must, well, literally in the Greek, who have the right of not working for a living? Go on to verse 12. If others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? Verse 12, second part. But we did not use this right. Verse 15, but I have not used any of these rights. The word rights is coming again and again and again. Exousia, authority, God-given, or given from outside, an authority I have received and that I can exercise and use. That's the sort of authority, the right, that is being talked about here. Notice how Paul strengthens his argument. He has every claim to certain rights as a Christian worker. He argues this first from the principle, look at verse 7, that the laborer in any area of work is worthy of his reward. He instances the soldier, the agricultural laborer, and the shepherd. If they're at work in any of those areas, they can all claim a share of the produce. Secondly, he quotes scripture, verses 8 to 10, the law of Moses in the Old Testament about not muzzling an ox, so that when it's treading out the grain, it can have a little nibble as well. And the principle, says Paul, isn't limited to animals. It applies far more to humans. God meant it for that, he says here. Thirdly, Paul appeals in verse 11 to the principle of contractual agreement, the principle of exchange, if we do this for you, you will do that for us. Agreed? An agreed idea. Fourthly, he points to the fact that in verse 12, the Corinthians evidently recognized that others had the right of support from them. So shouldn't Paul, their founder, their spiritual father, not have it even more? Next, the apostle reminds his readers of the ecclesiastical pattern set in the Old Testament temple. Verse 13 and 14, that those who served the temple received their share, their rake off, of the people's sacrifices and offerings, legitimately, so that those who preached the gospel should similarly expect to receive some provision. Rights, rights, rights. Of course, the greatest missionary who ever lived was Paul, and he could claim surely a high degree of support from the churches that he created and served. But, and twice we read it, there it is, the second part of verse 12, we did not use this right. Verse 15, but I have not used any of these rights. And Paul isn't fishing for support by manipulative techniques as he makes these points. Because look at the second part of verse 15. I am not writing this in the hope that you will do such things for me. I'd rather die than have anyone deprive me of this boast. Never will it be said of Paul that he had used or sponged on the indisciplined, muddled, and rebellious church at Corinth. Rights. Privileges. That's one of the great words that features in this passage. And the gospel, says Paul, shows us just how we should see our rights. We will put up, verse 12, we will put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. Hold that in your mind as we look at another Greek word in the passage. And it's the word evangel, comes out as euangelion, the gospel, and its related word to preach the gospel. That comes a number of times here. That word goes hand in hand with the word rights. Now we learn, secondly, that the gospel affects how we see not only our rights, but our rewards. Look at the word then for gospel or preaching the gospel. For example, end of verse 12, on the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. Verse 14, in the same way the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel. Can't get away from it. Verse 16, yet when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, for I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. He's harping on it. Verse 18, what then is my reward? Just this, that in preaching the gospel, I may offer, literally, the gospel, that's what it says in the Greek, free of charge, and so not make use of my rights in preaching the gospel. Same Greek word is used three times there. Verse 23, I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. So this is a little bit of Bible study we're doing. Two great words there. Rights and the gospel and preaching the gospel. How we see our rewards. Is there a reward then for preaching the gospel? Verse 17 actually spells out the issue. Namely, that a true preacher or witness of the gospel is called to it with an inner compulsion. So that the evangelist has to preach. No other option. Driven to it. Look at verse 17. If I preach voluntarily, I have a reward. If not voluntarily, I'm simply discharging the trust committed to me. The point is made that if you're a volunteer and think, oh, yeah, I could do a little bit of witnessing, why not? I'll give it a go, have a try. If you set yourself forward to propagate and spread the faith, then there is a sense in which you're only a peddler, selling your wares wherever there's a buyer, a And all the time you could be hoping for, indeed you're expecting, some sort of material reward. There are preachers like that. There are ministers like that. And full-time workers like that. You're on the make. You're a careerist. And there have been enough films and documentaries in recent years to support the sober New Testament observation that there are some areas of Christian service and ministry and church life and leadership in which all the arrows are pointing inwards instead of outwards. It's all for the hierarchy. It's all for the inner circle. It's all for the person at the center performing as a minister. That's what marks out the sect from the genuine church. The sects are saying, come to us. All the arrows are pointing inwards. Don't bother about anybody else. We are it. Nobody else counts but us. And you can make over your resources to us as we direct and guide your life from now on. Let the contributions, the material rewards, flow into us at the center. Oh, they don't put it in so many words. But that is the result. Is that the outlook of a person fired by biblical convictions? Verse 16 gives Paul's own answer. Yet when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, for I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. And then, second part of verse 17, I have a reward. If not voluntarily, I am simply discharging the trust committed to me. Verse 18, what then is Paul's situation? Why, he exhibited the same compulsion that thousands have in all of Christian history. They've been fired by the gospel. They've been held by it, riveted by it, and so they have no other option. They're going to preach it, spread it, witness it. John Bunyan, the famous tinker, who was also a preacher and a Christian author of the 17th century, imprisoned for some of his views, said from prison, if I were out of prison today, I would preach the gospel again tomorrow by the help of God. He had to preach. Paul had to preach. There was a compulsion. True, he didn't have to preach without material support. He didn't have to be a tent maker. He could have simply said to every church in sight, support me, come on. And this actually is his ground for boasting. It's a source of self-worth. That is his reward. As F.F. Bruce, the commentator, puts it in his commentary, Paul's highest pay is to serve without pay. No self-service. No sense of self-importance. The true minister of Christ is not self-conscious at all, or should not be self-conscious, but aware of others, aware of Christ, aware of the gospel, aware of the privilege of doing that. That's the reward. And the best exponents of that can be found in every century. Last century, D.L. Moody, the famous American evangelist. Oh, he was world famous. The greatest preacher of the century. He was once asked, would you kindly introduce Henry Ward Beecher, who is going to speak at this meeting? Moody said, what? Introduce Beecher? Not I. Ask me to black his boots and I'll do it gladly. Two great Greek expressions, the word rites, and then the word for gospel and preaching the gospel, telling us in effect that the priority of the gospel in our lives affects first how we see our rights, and secondly how we see our rewards. Then the priority of the gospel, thirdly, affects how we're to see our responsibilities. Yes, I've got a third word in the Greek here that is repeated like the other words, and it is the word kerdiso, which means I win. Can you see it? Verse 19 to 22. Though I am free, verse 19, and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak I became weak, to win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might, is a slightly different word, I might save some. Now that really comes across to us as you look at that word, kadiso, I win. The idea flows out of our key 12th verse there. We put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. So Paul will do anything to win people who are at the moment are outside the bonds of Christ and outside the love of God. And Paul, as a true son of the gospel, is out to win as many as possible, that's the phrase, by all means that are legitimate to the gospel. Being a Jew, he could think his way into the Jewish mindset and be a Jew to win the Jew. If it helped, Timothy, his younger associate, could be circumcised. If it helped not to eat certain meats, then for the Jews' sake he would refrain. But then to the Gentiles also, those described in verse 21 as not having the Jewish law. That's, by that he means Gentiles. Paul would prove adaptable in order to win them. He picks up on his argument of chapter 8 in verse 22 here with his reference to winning the weak. Though you'll notice that he doesn't go on an opposite tack and say that he'll become strong in order to identify with the strong. Because the whole emphasis here is on the cost of Christian witness and work. Nor is he ever going to say to the drunk, I became drunk. He's not going to say that. The idea is not to win people to himself or to his own ideas, but to bring them to what the end of verse 21 describes as being under Christ's law. This isn't unprincipled living. The liberals in church life have sometimes interpreted verse 2 about becoming all things to all men in terms of a sort of wishy-washy abandonment of principles and standards, and then we would have to ask them, how many people have you been enabled to save by the sell-out strategy? It's not that. The answer to that question would be seen in the emptying churches that seem so often to characterize such a feeble ministry. The 19th century missionary to China, Hudson Taylor, took up this principle himself in his desire to win Chinese people. So he dressed in Chinese clothes. He wore his hair in a pigtail. He looked Chinese. To all intents and purposes, he was Chinese. There may not be such a call for such adaptations in our now highly internationalized world scene. But I can think of a preacher to the Muslims here in London who deliberately cultivates a beard in the style of Muslim teachers. Or I can think of missionary women who wear the all-enveloping dark clothes of women in purdah. I admire them so much. Don't know how they do it. But Paul says we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel. Anything to win a dying world. And then C.H. Spurgeon, that great Baptist preacher of an earlier generation, once said, if we will not take pains for the kingdom of heaven, what kingdom will we take pains for? May we apply that to ourselves as a church and to ourselves as individuals, soul after soul, as many as possible, from whatever walk of life. Maybe some of us say, all this talk of evangelism, I could never do that. It is so hard. And if we think that, it's very good indeed. We should pity the Christian who thinks that evangelism is
dead easy.
Think of Paul, who earlier told the Corinthians, I came among you in fear and trembling. So if the mighty Paul could feel that, you and I can be excused for feeling that too. And here, these great words demonstrate how it's no accident when the gospel has such a hold on our lives that it's the number one priority. When it has that hold upon us, it will affect how we see our rights, how we see our rewards, and how we see our responsibility towards others in winning them. And then we might say, is this passage for Christians in general, as well as for the highly placed like apostles? It is. It's for any Christian, however new. Remember, Paul has been into a wider argument to Christians in general here in Corinthians about not using their freedom to trample others. So chapter 9 is in one sense just an illustration of that from Paul's own life. Of course, he goes on to apply it to the rest of us in verse 24. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run, he says to his readers. You run in such a way as to get the prize. It's for us too. And it only remains for us to look at the last little section of this chapter as Paul reinforces all that he's been saying with his vivid metaphor of an athletic contest. So there it is in verse 24 onwards, a race. Run in such way as to get the prize. Get into strict training, verse 25. We do this to get a crown that will last forever, unlike those athletes of Corinthian days who just got a pathetic little crown that would last a few hours and then it would shrivel. It's not so with Paul the Apostle. Not so with the Christians today. So they held these games at Corinth every 2 years, apparently, and the aspiring athletes had to go into training for a full 10 months. Very exacting. And Paul makes the obvious contrast there in verse 25. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last. But we do it to get a crown that will last forever. We're in training. That is what is implied by those verses 26 to 27. Training in self-discipline, in aims, in objectives, in asking ourselves the question that Jerome had to face. What am I most in life? How would a true obituary about you or me mark us out? What would be the main stamp upon our life? For Paul is concerned, even for himself, lest he lose focus, lest having preached to others he should miss out on the greatest rewards of being a gospel person. So he's talking about buffeting himself, keeping himself in training, strong discipline. When does he go to bed? When does he get up? What does he eat? What is his diet like? How is he focusing? And the greatest prize or reward at the end of the race is the discovery that you pleased your leader. Or you could discover that you'd not pleased your leader as you should. And the other reward would be in terms of those people that we shall meet in heaven. Maybe they will have reached heaven ahead of us. And what a reward to be at the gates of the celestial city, to come there yourself one day in the future, and to see somebody there already ahead of you, pointing you out to the gatekeeper and saying, here he is, here she is, that's the person that led me to faith in Jesus Christ. There they are. That person helped me to understand the Bible. Here they are. That's the person that taught me to pray. There they are. Here at last. What a reward that would be. We put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. Paul applies that to himself, but he applies it to us too. What are we most? Let's pray. God our Father, as we look at these words, they are really most deeply challenging. We know that we are not what we ought to be or could be, but we ask that we may be able by your grace to rise from what we are and to aspire after a greater centrality on the gospel. Help us to recognize that when everything else has been dismantled from this world, there will still be the gospel and your kingdom. Help us to be part of that permanence. We ask it for your name's sake. Amen.